After England's humiliation in the 1970 World Cup, two events in the world of international sport in particular gave 1971 something of a rosy glow. Both famous victories were won down under. The first in Australia. Brian Johnston.
In comes Underwood again now. Bill De Jenner builds this through wide the crease, a quicker one. And he goes off Batten Pad. He's caught. He's out caught. Underwood has got the wicket. He was caught there by Fletcher at Philly Point, and England have won the Ashes.
Then to New Zealand for the British Lions' first ever rugby union victory over the All Blacks. The commentator was Cliff Morgan.
So to the vital third test match at Wellington. And the Lions simply had to win. This is how they did it.
5 yards now from the All Black line. Can the Lions wrap this ball? They can to Edwards. Edwards going. Davis is there. Gerald Davis has scored a try. Taylor's deflection. Edwards. He's nearly under the post. Can he get there? To Barry John, and Barry John has scored. What a try.
New Zealand could only share the series now. And at Auckland, on the last day of the tour, the Lions needed only a draw to make history.
Scene of great hilarity as the final whistle blew, the Lions leapt into the air, congratulating Dr. Doug Smith and Carwin James, and they're standing in front now, lined up in front of the official enclosure, waving to the boys as they come back and receiving waves in return. You can't take it away from them, I should say. What a magnificent game today. 14-all after the All Blacks went into that 8-0 lead. It looked very difficult.
August the 14th, 1971, a day for rugby men to celebrate in the way that rugby men do.
Back home at Wembley, the Arsenal-Liverpool Cup final had to be decided in extra time.
9.5 minutes gone, a goal kick. And from the goal kick, Radford gets it, turns the ball in, feeds to George. George shoots, is there! This man, Charlie George from midfield, has put Arsenal 2-1 in the lead. And this means, of course, that Arsenal are within about 8 minutes of a double that has only been achieved once in this century by Spurs 10 years ago.
One of the most famous footballers England has ever produced, Jimmy Greaves, retired during the year. And so, after a controversial defeat, did one of the most popular ever British boxers, Henry Cooper.
I thought the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th rounds clinched the fight for me. Admittedly, he could have won the last round, but I thought them 3 or 4 rounds definitely clinched it for me, and I expected to win.
If 1971 in sport will mainly be remembered for the achievements of two teams from Britain playing overseas, it'll also be remembered for the achievements of two individuals, who were conscious that what they did entirely on their own. On the 6th of August, Che Blyth sailed into the little harbour at Hamble, Hampshire, after spending 10 months sailing around the world, against the prevailing currents, non-stop, and alone. Had he ever thought of giving up?
As far as giving up is concerned, there was no question about that. I was going to continue that regardless. But there was, in fact, two occasions when it was extremely interesting. Well, one occasion was, in fact, when I was thrown across the deck, and I didn't have a safety harness on, and I was thrown across the deck, and I was saved by a guardrail, and I was lying with the lee rail under, so that I was lying down below with the water sort of rushing over me. And the second situation was during a very severe storm, similarly again, when a wave broke over us, and for a split second I thought we were going to go down, only for a split second. You get these seas coming at you, and it doesn't take very long to really put you in your place. And really, no matter, I may be sitting here talking away and all the things, but we really are all quite insignificant, you know. And no matter how big we think we are, we'll make very little impression on this life, that's for sure.
Among the thousands waiting to welcome Che Blyth ashore was Princess Anne, who only a few weeks later, despite an operation that cut short her time for practice, won on her horse doublet the individual European 3-day event championship. What was her feeling as she came over that last fence and knew she couldn't be beaten?
Well, actually, I thought about it the third from last fence when I thought I'd only had two more to fall into, which, no, it was very exciting, because, you know, one had hoped that one would get to that stage.
Princess Anne. As the ice pack created by the Cold War began to break up, it became clear that some of the world's most bitter conflicts in the 1970s were going to be not between states, but within them. It was partly in hopes of ameliorating just such a conflict between whites and blacks in Rhodesia that Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, on behalf of the British government, reopened negotiations with the illegal regime there. Fully 6 years after UDI, agreement was reached in November between the British and Rhodesian governments. The essence of the agreement was that African progress towards majority rule was to be unimpeded, but very, very slow. Sir Alec was optimistic that the Rhodesians, for their part, would honour the agreement.
Well, I think that both in Rhodesia and outside, there's a general recognition that the country was moving faster on the road towards the South African pattern of life. And a great many people in Rhodesia don't want that at all. And so what I had to do was to try and change the direction of the constitution to make it different from what it is now, because there's no possibility now of going beyond parity, and we've got to get majority rule. And secondly, of course, the individual has no protection in the courts at present because the declaration of rights that they have is non-justiciable. So we had to get this justiciable. So Mr. Smith has got to put through these changes, very big constitutional changes, a blocking mechanism for Africans, a new franchise, transition through parity to majority rule. Got to put them with all his authority and the authority of his parliament through parliament. Now, this is a pretty big exercise for him. Having done that, I wouldn't have thought Rhodesia would go back on them.
But Dennis Healy, Labour spokesman on foreign affairs, was sceptical.
There's no guarantee whatever that even a single one of those principles is going to be met. It could be 30 to 50 years before the Africans even have equality in Parliament with the Europeans, although they have a majority of 20 to 1 in the country as a whole. There's no guarantee of any effective nature that the Smith regime will not go back on the agreement the moment it gets the sanctions taken off, if it ever does. There's no guarantee even that the appalling Land Tenure Act will be removed. And above all, there's no guarantee that when the commission which Britain appoints to find out whether the Africans accept the agreement goes to Rhodesia, there will be genuine freedom of speech and organisation so that African leaders like Mr. Nkomo can express their view and organise support for it.
The views of the Rhodesian Prime Minister himself, Mr. Ian Smith, were expressed obscurely, probably deliberately so. The supporters of the agreement in Britain could take comfort from his words, but its critics could claim with equal force that Mr. Smith was out of his own mouth confirming their worst fears.
We've hoped for this, and now it has come. So it's a relief. As I have always maintained, there would have to be give and take, and we've both had to give and take. Neither side have got everything they wanted. I suppose it's only natural for me to think that I've got the best of the bargain. I've no doubt Sir Alec Douglas Hume thinks he's got the best of the bargain. This is human nature, isn't it? I'm satisfied, and my colleagues, on after our assessment of the position, that we are going to retain government in civilized hands. I have always stated that I accept majority rule, providing it is responsible majority rule. In fact, I've often said that we have majority rule today in Rhodesia. I represent the majority of the voters in Rhodesia. As long as it is responsible majority rule, I accept this. I reiterate, I think we are going to be successful in retaining government in civilized hands. I think time is on our side.
The black man's struggle for equality in America, which in earlier years had issued in riots in the centers of America's largest cities, came in 1971 to be symbolized in the persons of two individuals, both highly articulate, whose own lives were a commentary on the system they sought to change. One was George Jackson, the Soledad brother, who'd spent the whole of his adult life in prison, and who, soon after reading aloud this letter, was to be shot down by prison guards.
To everyone who has, will more be given. But from him who has not, even what he has will be taken away. I don't like this life. I can never reconcile myself to it. Or rationalize the fact that I've been basely used, hated, and repressed, as if it were the natural order of things.
The other symbol of black America was Angela Davis, a self-professed communist, a university teacher of philosophy, accused after an attempt to break up a trial of murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy. She declared after her arrest that the struggle would go on.
There's nothing, absolutely nothing, which could deter me from continuing to fight with all my energies for the freedom of my people. And there's no need for me to cry because I've been captured. But there's all the more reason to be strong and keep fighting. I will not be free until all black people are free.
In Uruguay, hitherto one of the most peaceful countries in Latin America, the British ambassador, Jeffrey Jackson, spent 8 months the hostage of urban guerrillas, the Tupamaras. Released after a massive jailbreak by other Tupamaras, Sir Jeffrey ruminated on his experiences, rather as though he'd been out for a Sunday afternoon walk.
One of the young men in particular was extremely... I don't think he was cruel. I think he was hysterical. I noticed, in fact, that his hands were very wet, and actually mine were dry. So I suspect, you know how it is on these occasions, I was really too engrossed to be frightened, whereas he was, I think, poor child, extremely frightened. There was no point in trying anything spectacular, as the, I don't know whether it was Nancy Mitford said, in a rather different connotation, all I could do was clench my teeth and think of England, or Britain, I should say. Incidentally, I apologise. I gather that I'm a bit husky. That's because my vocal cords, the doctor tells me, have been out of action. Also, I think the real reason, too, is that I've picked up a blessed English cold, and I can't tell you how glad I am to have it.
Most people in the United Kingdom had got used over the years to the idea that internal conflicts of the Rhodesian or American or Uruguayan type were the sorts of things that happened to other people in other countries. By 1971, they knew better, as the Prime Minister reminded his fellow guests at the Lord Mayor's banquet.
My Lord Mayor, within these islands, inside the boundaries of the United Kingdom, we are confronted with a determined, indeed ruthless attack by terrorists on our own community. This attempt to destroy the fabric of society in Northern Ireland by violence cannot be tolerated. Terrorism serves only to postpone the day of reconciliation, on which alone future progress can be built.
But the terrorism, thefts, bombings, shootings, unleashed early in the year by the IRA, went on nonetheless. It was, if anything, intensified by the declaration of Mr. Brian Faulkner, the Northern Ireland Prime Minister who'd replaced Major Chichester Clark.
I have had to conclude that the ordinary law cannot deal comprehensively or quickly enough with such ruthless viciousness. I have therefore decided, after weighing all the relevant considerations, including the views of the security authorities, and after consultation with Her Majesty's government in the United Kingdom last Thursday, to exercise, where necessary, the powers of detention and internment vested in me as Minister of Home Affairs.
Scores of suspected IRA collaborators were interned during the following weeks and months, but the number of bombings and shootings, far from diminishing, increased sharply. Clifford Luton described the most horrifying of the incidents.
This was the worst bomb outrage in the 2 years of violence in Ulster, the disaster everyone saw coming. 15 people lie dead or dying under this burning pile of wreckage. People who, a few minutes before, were enjoying a Saturday evening glass of beer. McGurk's Bar, a backstreet pub in the heart of one of Belfast's Catholic areas, was blown apart by the explosion. Horrified rescuers first on the spot swarmed over the mountain of burning rubble, tearing frantically at shattered brick and timber in their efforts to reach the dead and dying.
And try and get into a series of chains of straight lines.
The official opposition withdrew in a body from the Stormont Parliament. And at the United Nations, Britain was denounced by the Foreign Minister of the Irish Republic, Dr. Patrick Hillary.
British troops have been used in one-sided armed searches and to implement a policy of mass arrests and internment. From a peacekeeping force, they have become, in the eyes of the minority, a coercive instrument to prop up the northern regime. It is in these events that we can find the causes of the present violence.
Nevertheless, the Labour opposition at Westminster continued reluctantly to support internment, which could be and was justified on the grounds that it was the only way of dealing with armed and determined terrorists. Reginald Modling, the Home Secretary.
I think the use of internment, which has often been used, and often several times been used, both north and south of the border, is a perfectly appropriate weapon to deal with an armed organisation which not only kills British soldiers and innocent people, but boasts that it's doing so. So far as internment is concerned, it has been aimed solely at those who are actively associated with the IRA and their campaign of violence. No one wants internment. I've said myself more than once that internment, imprisonment without trial, or of course there was a right of appeal, imprisonment without trial is a hideous thing, but it's not as hideous as murder.
And towards the end of the year, Sir Harry Tuzo, the British commander in Northern Ireland, claimed to be not too unhappy about the security situation.
I can be soberly optimistic about prospects for 1972. More than that, I don't think I need say.
But the hatreds in Northern Ireland ran deep, deeper perhaps than anyone outside could understand. In Londonderry in November, a young girl, Martha Doherty, was tarred and feathered for the crime, for crime it had become, of going out with a British soldier. A BBC reporter asked a woman in the bogside what she would do if she found her daughter going out with a soldier.
I would hand her out to the women who took the girl last night.
And have her tarred and feathered? Do you know this girl that was in trouble last night, Martha?
Yeah, Martha Doherty.
Well, what do you feel about it?
I think she deserved it.
Why do you think that?
Well, I mean, we're nuts. We've been out all week now, up at the barricades and all. I don't think it's fair her being out with soldiers, with the men and the women that are on the barricades. Like, that's the likes of her should be out. She's from a bog side and she should act like it.
Probably for most people in Britain, stories of bombings and killings in Northern Ireland became monotonous, as terrible things so often do. But in fact, there was nothing monotonous. The victims of every separate act of terrorism were unique, however much their experience was shared. Apart from waging a war of attrition against the terrorists, no one seemed clear at the end of 1971 how or by whom the troubles in Northern Ireland could be ended. Harold Wilson was almost the only British politician to make concrete suggestions, in particular the creation of a united Ireland within the Commonwealth. But even he wasn't sanguine about the outcome.
I know it'll shock a lot of people. I know that people in the North will not like some of the things I said. People in the South won't like it either. But they've got to get away from slogans now and really face up to the situation, because men are being killed every day. It's going to be hell for a lot of people. It's going to be hell for the people in the South to accept, for example, my proposal that they should join the Commonwealth and accept the Queen as head of the Commonwealth. But I think people in the North want to maintain a link with the Crown in that way.
But the bitterest conflict of all in 1971 wasn't in Rhodesia or Northern Ireland. It engulfed the whole of the Indian subcontinent, led to war between India and Pakistan, and threw into sharp relief the new patterns of world power that were emerging, with Russia supporting India, China backing Pakistan, and the United States uneasily trying to hold the ring. The people of East Pakistan, Bangladesh, wanted complete independence from the West, or at least virtual autonomy in a loose federation. Riots in the East led to the imposing of martial law, the massacre of thousands of Bengali civilians, and the flight to India of 9 million more. President Yahya Khan of Pakistan declared his determination to hold the nation together.
Let me make it absolutely clear that no matter what happens, as long as I'm in command of Pakistan Armed Forces and the head of state, I will ensure complete and absolute integrity of Pakistan. Let there be no doubt or mistake on this point.
India could hardly be expected to stand aside. The flight of refugees across her frontiers confronted the Indian government with terrible problems of food and housing. The people of East Bengal undoubtedly desired their independence. Above all, the Indians saw at long last an opportunity to cripple their arch enemies, the Pakistanis, and to be freed forever from the danger of having to fight a war against Pakistan on two fronts. Mrs. Gandhi, the Indian Prime Minister, felt little need to justify her country's position.
Let us put this in perspective. War is an evil thing. India has always stood out against war, no matter where it took place. But there are things which are more important. And today we feel that not only for the sake of the Indian people, but for the peace in Asia, and I would say world peace, stability, integrity, and the security of India is the first importance.
After many weeks of sporadic shelling across the eastern frontier, all-out war finally came at the beginning of December. The Indian Army, fighting a holding action in the west, concentrated most of its energies on capturing the Pakistani forces in the east and the East Pakistani capital of Dhaka. The whole operation, described by an Indian Army colonel, took only a fortnight.
They were planning to fight here a protracted battle. And as you'll go around and see the dumps in this area, you'll realize that they were here to fight. Now, they did not realize that we could come with such speed and determination to off-balance them. And they were expecting us to fight a normal gradual battle, which is as given out in the books. So they were completely cut off. They were completely isolated from various directions by the infantry and finally annihilated in this position. They were here to fight, and if I had this ammunition, I would have fought it out till the last man, last round. I think they had no reason to get out from this place. But it only shows that the cause was not there, the determination was not there, and they knew they were fighting in a foreign land.
Ronald Robson was present when the Pakistani troops finally surrendered, before a huge crowd of cheering Bengalis at, of all places, the Dhaka racecourse.
I think perhaps it was wrong to allow all the civilians in here, but they're in, cheering. And here is General Arora. And now they're all heading for the table, where the surrender documents will be signed. Bengal Ghazi stands there, looking rather grim. He's reading the surrender document now. General Niazi is now signing. General Arora has already signed. And even as the two generals sign the papers, we can still hear the sounds of small arms fire from across the race course. It's almost dark now. The two generals have shaken hands. And General Niazi, with almost tears in his eyes, has taken off his pistol and has handed it to General Arora.
Yeah, that's true. Also get it.
This is a sad moment for a general who, by the way, is so well known to some of his adversaries. He had nothing but good to say of him.
At the end of the year, it seemed certain that the new state of Bangladesh would rise from the ashes of East Pakistan. But whether the new state would be more than a client of India, and what attitude China would take towards it, were still unknowns. The humiliation suffered by proud Pakistanis was enormous. It was hard to believe that they wouldn't one day seek revenge. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, soon to be president of Pakistan, stormed out of a meeting of the United Nations Security Council.
I find it disgraceful to my person and to my country to remain here a moment longer than necessary. But I am not boycotting. Impose any decision. Have a treaty worse than the Treaty of Versailles. Legalize aggression. Legalize occupation. Legalize everything that has been illegal till 14th or 15th of December 1971. I will not be a party to it. We will fight. We'll go back and fight. My country hearkens for me. Why should I waste my time here in the Security Council? I will not be a party to the ignominious surrender of part of my country. You can take your Security Council. Here you are. I'm going.
Perhaps one of the oddest things about 1971, one of the surest pieces of evidence that the world's great powers were indeed entering a new epoch and forming new patterns, was the almost total silence and indifference with which the outside world greeted the signature of an East-West settlement on Berlin. Here was a dispute which for more than a quarter of a century had been at least an irritant between the Soviet bloc and NATO, and at times a possible, even probable, cause of nuclear war. Yet when in 1971 a settlement was finally reached, guaranteeing the rights of the Western powers in Berlin, but also permitting West Berliners to travel to the East, no one seemed much surprised. And the event called for no more than a bland statement from the American Secretary of State, Mr. William Rogers.
This act marks an important step forward, and it's pursuant to President Nixon's personal initiative and desire for reconciliation between East and West. It embraces not only the promise of a better way of life for Berliners, but enhances the prospects for greater peace and security in Europe.
As though to symbolize the end of one era, the beginning of a new, one Secretary General of the United Nations, only the third in the history of the office, retired, and another was nominated to serve in his place. U Thant announcing his retirement, Riley acknowledged that, like so many other monuments from the post-war world, the UN was sometimes now consigned to the wings of the international stage.
There is one aspect of the role of the Secretary General which is no less important for being fortuitous or for lacking any description in the Charter. There comes a time in affairs of nations when it is eminently desirable to pass the buck. The United Nations as an organization is often an ideal recipient of the buck. And it follows the Secretary General can easily become a scapegoat in dangerous situations where no solution can be found.
It was left to U Thant's successor, Kurt Waldheim of Austria, to remind the world of the significance of the new place that China was about to assume in world affairs. The UN Kurt Waldheim was to head would be a very different UN from the one which, only 20 years before in Korea, had been officially at war with Red China.
At present, the United Nations has arrived at an important crossroads. The participation of the People's Republic of China is a major step on the road towards universality, which will no doubt increase the United Nations' capability of working for the objectives of the Charter.
No doubt increase? Well, perhaps. None of us could be sure. The ice was melting too fast, the currents flowing too swiftly.